Will you stand with Israel or will you stand with the terrorists? We must know the answer to that question now. Now, not later. Because if Israel is again asked to take more risk for peace, we must know today that you will stand with us tomorrow. Only if we have the confidence that we can defend ourselves can we take further risks for peace. And make no mistake about it, all of Israel wants peace.
Live from New York, this is the Beebe Report Live Show on Israel.
To know the truth when it matters the most, reports, public opinion, and more, visit our blog at bbreport.blogspot.com or on Twitter at bbreport. Or listen to our extended radio show every Monday night at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time with a panel of experts and analysts on Blog Talk Radio.
Our upcoming guest is Aliza Davidovich. Aliza is a published writer, author, journalist, and former TV producer. She worked at ABC News 2020 for 6 years with Connie Chung and in the ABC News Terrorism Investigations Unit with John Miller. Aliza was also a producer and booker at the Fox News Channel, where she helped launch Fox Premier live audience news show Dayside. In addition, she hosted and produced her own Judaic TV show, JTV New York, for 2 years. Prime Minister Netanyahu noted on Aliza, "I give Ms. Davidovich the highest praise I know for a journalist. She was, above all, fair and objective." And this is what Jackie Mason, comedian, had to say about her. Aliza has the brains of Henry Kissinger. She made me appear even more interesting than I ever thought I was. In addition to interviewing the world's most famous faces, from prime ministers to entertainment icons, she also writes a weekly religion blog, The Source, inspiring both evangelical Christians and Jews across the world. Davidovich also appears regularly on Fox News Strategy Room. The Ivy League educated journalist with a master's in science has taken all her unusual life experiences and unfolded them in her new book, The Words That Shaped Me. A journalist, brilliant, touching, and hilarious journey through the dictionary and life, with social commentary and great wisdom. Aliza takes the reader on an adventure through the dictionary, selecting the words that have shaped both her and society. She learned early on in life that words may be the most powerful tools in the world. They are like time-release capsules which either sustain us or poison us as we go. Aliza also proves how very untrue the adage, sticks and stones can break your bones, but words can never harm you, is. Affirming words' power, she points out how even God created the world through words, and how they continually create our realities. She uses each word as a trampoline to launch her thoughts on every subject: religion, politics, weddings, sickness, fears, emails, adultery, and so much more. by books, and the reason I only learned new words as I learned reading the book all night, but will never think of the words they already know the same again. So with great honor and respect, I welcome Miss Eliza Davidovit. Shalom, and thank you for stopping by this evening.
Well, thank
good evening.
You so much. Hello?
Yes, you're on air.
I'm on air. Hi, thank you very much for having me. You did such a good job at introducing me. I'm ready to leave now.
Listen, I spent like 8 or 9 hours reading your book, so from my time...
Listen, I wouldn't be the first Jewish woman to keep a man up at night, right? With aggravation and stress.
Well, I won't use any words for this comment. First, let's start by exploring the book. And I got to tell you, this is the first time I read a book so fast. You start the book with a description of your name, Eliza. Eliza means happy in Hebrew. And this is what you write. Happiness was the farthest thing I felt in my heart for many years. But now, with older eyes, I realize the true blessing in my name. I think today that I'm the happiest person I know, and I'm incredibly proud of the person I have become. Happiness, I realized, is not merriment and easy fun. It's a process of self-discovery, of self-confidence, of withstanding the challenges, becoming stronger, independent, and living in purpose. In brief, can you describe to the audience tonight the challenges you faced in life that you have reached this point being proud and happy about yourself?
If your audience is ready to take the psychiatrist's couch, I'm ready. But as a little girl, I happen to have been very shy, and it did a big service to me because I made no friends in school by being a shy person. And I grew up in a family of around 8 cousins. We were European. So, you know, European families are very close. Everybody's a brother and sister. But it was my mazel, my luck, that I was the youngest of the family. So I was the remote control for everybody. Get up and change it, and you do this, and you do that. And it actually had an influence on me because, you know, when you're the smallest, you really want to be big, and you want to be respected, and you want to be a contender. So it left its mark on me. On top of that, the reason that I have the name Eliza is because I was born after my parents had just buried a daughter. She had cancer at the age of 3, and my mother tells me when she was burying her first daughter, she felt her first kick in her stomach from me. So I was born in the shadow of somebody else, and I had a hard time growing up in terms of my own personality contributed to it. My family helped along the way, and I just had a hard time because I tend not to be a traditional character. And when you stand out, as our people do, the Jews, you know, when you stand out and you're a little bit different, you're not always accepted along the way. So I had a hard time growing up. And, you know, Freud, I'm not the one who invented it tonight, but Freud will say when you have a hard time growing up, it will have its impact on you. And then I did have a hard time in life because I lost a father. I lost a first cousin. My mother was in the nursing home business, so every day I'd come home from school to meet my elderly friends in the nursing home, and every day another friend would be gone. So my life has been built around a lot of losses and a lot of hurts because I was a soft personality. Another person will say, what's she complaining about? I was abused and slapped, and it's okay, and I'll take that criticism upon myself, but you can only feel your own pain, and you go with what you know. So for me, I had to go against the whole world in my mind, being this soft, shy little girl, going up against a big world where everyone was taller and stronger and louder than me. And I had to go against the blessing in my name, which is Eliza. Where was the happiness in that story? But I did learn along the way that everything is a learning process, and you can either take the moment and let it make you negative, or you can access it, you can manipulate it, and you can use it, and you can benefit from it. And that's what I chose to do. I chose to find the blessing in my name. Maybe because I was given that name, I felt that I had that holy grail at the end. but I never let the hard times bring me down. I only let them bring me up. The criticism, the hurt, the rejection. For me, as you mentioned before, the word trampoline, the words were the trampoline. For me, everything that was negative in my life was a trampoline to the positive.
You recall in your book your father's name, David, and here's what you write. It was in my father's story as a decorated veteran that my Zionism was born. It was in his longings for the beaches of Haifa and vivid tales about Ariel Sharon that Israel became my legacy too. And it was in his story that I learned that without the existence of the Jewish homeland, every Jew is an orphan. Yes, David means beloved. My beloved father, who like his biblical namesake, stood against life's Goliath and prevailed. And like the Star of David on the Israeli flag, he is forever my protector, my shining and guiding star, and a radiant light sparkling over Zion. What have you learned from your father on the existence of Israel as a Jewish state, especially in our days that the legitimacy of Israel is attacked and our so-called peace partners reject even recognizing our historical bond to the Jewish homeland?
Well, I could start by saying that it's probably ominous because yesterday was my father's birthday, so I feel very honored to be speaking about him today. My father was a very optimistic person, but he was also a realist. And when he told me about the stories of Israel, and he told me about the stories about Ariel Sharon, it was never that things were going to be easy for our people. We have to fight for every inch of ground that we're going to walk on. Israel cannot put the luxury of lives into the hands of other people. We have to take our lives into our own hands. And it's not by just mere rhetoric that he said that. We are the most persecuted people in the history of the world. We made ourselves very comfortable in every country and every terrain that welcomed us. But at the end of the day, they hated us, they threw us out, and no matter who we were at the end of the day, whether we were a prime minister, a doctor, or the richest person in the town, the bottom line was, and the lowest common denominator for them was, that we were a Jew. So taking that into account, we have a whole world now surrounding us and conglomerating against us to delegitimize Israel, to delegitimize our history, our Bible, our Holocaust. Everybody is honing in against us, and we cannot put our fate in the hands of other people. I think that Benjamin Netanyahu realizes this. I mean, we have a president now in the office. I don't know if he's the best friend Israel ever had, and that's a euphemism by a big exaggeration. But bring it back to my father, because I don't want to take this, you know, beyond where this question was. If I would have to tell you what my father would tell me, and if he would be the eighth of the advice that giving me today, he would say, you're going to have to fight. And he would say what Jefferson said, every tree of liberty has to be watered by the blood of patriots. Unfortunately, Israel had a lot of water to give to its trees.
Absolutely, and you know, this is an ongoing fight, and only as you describe in your book, only by seeing ourselves as David, we could prevail, and hopefully we will prevail. Describe in brief what you write about your difficult entry into, I know, because it's an interesting topic, I would like to listen to your thoughts. Your difficult entry into the religious world as a Jew with different standards. What does the Jewish identity, in your point of view, unite all individuals?
Well, unfortunately, I can't point to the Jews to tell you how we are united as Jews, because Jews are fighting left and right. You have in Israel, literally, the left and right want to kill each other. You have the left telling a prime minister, make friends with the Arabs, but the left can't even make peace with their own prime minister. So Jews are known to be fighting a lot among each other. We know that's why the temple fell down, because it was sinat chinam, there was hatred among Jews. If you ask me why Jews are united, I will tell you Hitler is the best example why Jews are united. Because whether I wore an outfit that is not sneeze or modest by Jewish standards, or I, whatever, if I didn't wear a yarmulke or whatever it is, I was still a Jew. So through the eyes of Hitler, and I would never use him as an example because I'm the most Zionistic and conservative and patriotic and everything you can imagine, but through the eyes of Hitler, a Jew has to look at another Jew. Because if we were bad enough for him, we should be good enough for each other.
Indeed. You know, we talk a lot on this show, and people know that we are religious conservative Jews with different views than the vast majority of the liberal Jews here in the United States, and as we stick up for our government policies in Israel. We know the importance of unity, to speak in one voice for not only defending Israel's right to defend itself, but its existence as a Jewish nation. And therefore, the unity is an important tool that has to be used despite our differences. And let's hope that from our mouth to God's ears that this will happen.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but all the blessings that the Jewish people have received in history, with the climax of being Har Sinai, is when the Jews were together strong as one. As one. There has to be love. It doesn't matter if a Jew doesn't keep Shabbos. He should be the Jew you love even more, because he's the Jew you have to help. You know, we have to be a little bit less judgmental. And I'm Shomeret Shabbat, and I keep kosher, and I keep everything. But I recognize one thing. We have to be a little bit nicer to each other. We have to be. How do you expect anyone else to be nice to us if we can't be just a little bit nicer to each other?
Absolutely. Scrolling down to letter E, and you write this. The letter E seems to have taken on an errant life of its own. E words have seeped into our vernacular and infiltrated our lives like a communist regime, becoming the epicenter of our universe, email, etc. We live in an E reality. We did not eliminate the E's on time, and in turn, they have eliminated us. And you bring examples of the pros and cons using the email, social media. What do you think we should take advantage of and use this tool called the social media, as you call the E, for the benefits of not only our personal life, but also advocating for global and important activities that could spread the media and reach every part of the world?
Okay, so we are living in this reality right now. And if you go onto Facebook and some of these sites, you will find people who really hate Israel. And they want to delegitimize us, and they want to kill us. There's 1,000 groups on Facebook, at least, who want to bring us down. And today there's a war of words going on. We have to use this same medium that's being used against us to advance our causes, to spread the word, to put out the knowledge. You know, there was a time when the challenge for the Jewish people was, let my people go. Today, the challenge is, let my people know, because we have a new generation who knows nothing about Israel, who knows nothing about our history, who knows nothing why so many people died in the Jewish homeland to save them, that they can walk free in the streets of America. So we have to use the e-world to advance our cause and to counteract all those people who are now trying to use it to destroy us. And it's very funny because you started off, I wasn't part of this program, but you were speaking earlier about Iran and how this the Stuxnet computer worm was used to destroy one-fifth of the centrifuges in Iran. So we have a new way. We have a new method of reaching out to the enemy. The same way they're trying to reach out to us to destroy us, we have the countermeasure now to reach back at them. So Israel didn't have to have Jewish women and boys die flying over Iran and trying to take any, you know, nuclear site out, but they invaded them through computer technology, through the internet, which is really fascinating. Although Israel won't say it's them, but, you know, many are saying it was a a combined Israel and American effort here.
Well, we would give at least credit to whoever did it that it slowed down the development, but it has only slowed down the development, only destroyed a fifth and not the whole equipment that they have over there. So
right, but you know, it's funny, when I interviewed the former ambassador to the UN, Gabriela Shalev, she said to me, Israel is the only country in the world that is threatened on a daily basis. So if we are slowing it down by a few years, it's okay, because we have new threats every day, and that we slowed it down by 3 years is a long-term plan for the Jewish state.
Yeah, talking about E, do you know who else's name is starts with the E? That's our co-host, Eric Vogt, and he does...
Hi, Eric.
Good evening. I've been having a great time listening. This is just absolutely wonderful, Lisa. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me. It's really an honor, a pleasure, and really I'm grateful for it.
Elisa, this is repaying time, because I usually let Eric ask the questions, and the past interviews, he has let me die of boredom while broadcasting the show, so I'm paying him back now by asking all the questions. I'll give him one or two questions to ask, just so you know he shouldn't throw the phone down on the floor.
Eric, well, thank you for that.
So, I'm having a wonderful time listening, so this is great.
And
to
all the listeners that have internet, you could actually follow Eric on Twitter, where he tweets usually about our show on at Am Yisrael Chai 48. Scrolling down to the next page, God, and you write, my faith in and fear of God have been the most empowering directives in my life. In Italy, I had believed that God was a big Pez dispensing corporation in the sky with the logo, it's all fate. Such a belief strips us of control. It implies that the fabric of the world has already been woven with its faults and flaws, and that destiny is predestined. Hence, the result of our efforts will always be limited, but now, when I seek God, I look not up to the heavens, but deep inside me. In the Garden of Eden, the all-knowing God called out to Adam and Eve after they sinned and asked, where are thou? This too is a strange statement question for a God who is supposed to be the big brother, to see everything. This question was a moral alarm clock meant to awaken man to his duty to himself and humanity. Where are you in this life? What are you doing to co-create the universe? We are not meant to be silent partners who only show up to collect our paychecks. What has driven you personally to believe in God the Almighty? And what is our answer in today's day to God's question, where are you?
Well, to begin, I would say what led me to believe in God, so I would be different from somebody else. I think we're all equal shareholders in God. And God is in all, every single person, God is there equally. If you are ready to open your eyes and find him, that is already your business. But God is inside of all of us, and what we do with that depth and that potential is really in our hands. And it's interesting, because God named the first man, he didn't name him, oh God, and reach the sky. He named the first man Adam, which means Adam in Hebrew, which means from the earth. How low can you get? But the earth at the end of the day is replete with potential, and what you plant in it and how you sow it and how you water it and how you treat it, that's what will grow. And that's what will come from the earth. And that's what each one of us is, a child of Adam. And what will be, and how we'll grow, and how we will affect the universe, and what will become of us, is like we're the earth. It's all in our hands. So to ask, where are we? You know, every person has their clarion call. Where are they? Some people, they're happy. They're at Bloomingdale's, and they're at Saks Fifth Avenue. I don't think that that's what life was meant for. We're not on one big shopping trip and one big vacation and one big golf tournament. If that's, I mean, if you're happy with that, maybe you'll have a luxury bigger than me, because I never thought that that was what life was all about. Although I had those opportunities, I could have been at the shopping mall. It's not. I think that we're here to elevate life, to be the earth, to plant it, to sow the ground, and to make this world a better place. God gave us a perfectly half-finished place. He gave us the wheat in the field, and it's up to us to go and make the bread. We're here to make this world a better place. God didn't need man. He didn't need us. But he put us here, and he gave us a world that we should. It's called like tikkun olam, to come. In Hebrew, it's called tikkun olam. You come and you correct the world. You're here to serve a purpose. And the purpose, I believe, is not in Saks or Bloomingdale's. It's a much bigger purpose than that. To be honest, people invite me today to go to Broadway and to go to a show and to go to a movie, and I can't do it because the world, I feel, is in such torment, and we're in such... I feel sadness in my heart for the world that I can't go out and celebrate. And it sounds like a big exaggeration, but I think in the Torah that when Joseph was thrown into his pit and his brothers were eating... And it's pointed out in the Bible, how could they be eating when he's suffering in a pit? I can't be having fun when I think that the world is crumbling. I think we're here to correct the world and save it. So when you ask where in the question where God is going to the Garden of Eden and saying, where are you? You have to ask that question to yourself, where are you? Are you here just to exist and make time fly? Or are you here to make time matter? And that's all I have to say, and I'm sticking to the story.
listen.
I agree with you.
If you need something from Bloomingdale's, I could bring you.
You could bring me? Okay, well, listen, there was always that item I saw on the second floor. No, but, you know, it's very funny. No, it's very funny because, you know, if somebody will see me, I tend to, you know, I appear to be a flashy type of character. That's my persona. And if you look at the cover of the book, it's also as a flashy persona. But there is so much depth here, and there's so much connection to really what I believe the world is really about, to God, to soul, to correcting the universe, to doing the right thing, to helping people. I mean, that's what it's about. And people have asked me, why did I pick the type of cover I picked, which is not a conservative type of cover? And I think it's because I wanted to prove the point that you could look one way, but you could really be something else. And I don't believe that people should judge people just by the way they look or who they think they are. Oh, you're a Jew, you must be cheap. You're a Black, oh my God, I'm hiding my wallet, I'm locking my doors. Oh, you're a Muslim, oh my God, that's it, the world is coming to an end, the bomb is falling on my head. I mean, we really need to open up our minds because it makes us prejudiced, it puts people into stereotypes, it makes us small. And I don't think that's what God wanted this world to be about. God is not judging us by, you're a liberal, you're a Democrat, or you're this, you're that. I don't think so. I don't think so. Although I have my very strong opinions on politics and on religion and everything, and I tend to be extremely right. Ariel Sharon would have to move over a little for me, how right I get. But I just think that we need to be a little bit more open-minded and a little bit nicer about the way we treat people, even though they fall under a certain label.
You couldn't have been more righter than that. Here are some other people you have really met in real life and what brought you to think about them before and after. I'm just bringing an example of people that are known. You say Bill Clinton is larger than life on TV and larger than life in reality. Hillary Clinton has cold eyes. Mayor Michael Bloomberg appears robotic on TV. In real life, he's even more so. I found him a cold, rigid person. Eric Cantor, you can be observant Jew and a serving congressman. On Wolf Blitzer, questions can often be more impactful than answers. And Eric, you know what I mean. So...
Yes.
I could definitely agree with you on all that you have mentioned, but what made you reach that conclusion?
Okay, well, I mean, if I have to take them one at a time,
yeah,
I'll just tell
you.
I mean, I, you have time. I've met Hillary Clinton because I attend many events. I cover Jewish events and different political events in the city. So I've met a lot of these people and covered the events. So I've met Hillary Clinton at quite a few AIPAC in different scenarios. Also in Washington when she was addressing, I think it was a media watch who had a meeting there. I don't see a soul in her eyes. I mean, this is a personal opinion, you know, but I think I'm a good judge of character because it says in the Talmud, what comes from the heart reaches the heart, and I only operate from the heart, and that's why I'm true to what I do. So when I see people, I see right away, where are you coming from? I look at her in the face. She does not have a heart because a heart will stand for something and it will fall for something, and, it, you know, I didn't see, like, a soul there. Steely cold eyes. That's my impression. She could be the nicest person I ever met. You should ask Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, you see him on TV, and there's just something about the guy, and I happen to be a big Republican, but you see Bill Clinton on TV, there's something charming about him, a little bit larger than life on TV. I figured I'd see him in TV, you know, because I've interviewed many people, and once you meet them in person and they're not with the camera and lighting, I mean, they come down to size. Bill Clinton didn't come down to size. He really didn't. There's something so energetic and such magnetism. And I'm not one of these women who likes Bill Clinton and thinks he's hot. I'm not one of them. It's just there was something there. There was a presence. And I think God, in a way, whether you like the leaders or not, puts a crown on every leader. And I think everywhere that Jews live, they have to even bless the leader of their land. Who else did you mention there? Okay, Mayor Bloomberg. Mayor Bloomberg, I got the biggest flu of my life from Mayor Bloomberg. I shook his hands. He had the flu. He gave it to me. It was the only proof I have so far that he wasn't a robot because he is so he's so unnatural. He's the only person that I've interviewed that I actually didn't make them cry. 98% of the people that I interview, actually I've been called the Barbara Walters of print journalism because I make them cry. I shoot from the heart, it touches the heart. Him, no matter what I ask him, how did you bury your father, what happened? You can ask him any question, but, you know, so systematic, nothing going on there. So my impression of him, he was a little bit too robotic for my liking.
Did he also have
it all wrong about the mosque on Ground Zero, but that's
and about even about the snow blizzard.
Everything about him. I'm not happy with him. I mean, it's not so good I say this on radio because I'll have a ticket on my car every morning now, but...
I got a ticket already.
What's that?
I say you got a ticket already, so...
I got a ticket already, and I'm parked in my garage here. Okay.
Before Eric wants to get into this, I just wanted to ask you, you talk about bringing tears to eyes. Have you had a chance to interview House Speaker John Boehner? Because he intends to cry on every emotional occasion.
Okay, so for me, I would be very proud if I'd be the only person who didn't make him cry. Listen, at the end of the day, you know, I've been watching Obama for, 2 years now plus, and he has no feelings whatsoever. So it's nice to see somebody cry. If you put Obama and Boehner in a blender, maybe you'll have like the perfect man at the end of the day.
Okay, next, Wolf Blitzer.
Wolf Blitzer. So Wolf Blitzer was at a press conference once with Anwar Sadat. And he asked a question to Anwar Sadat, and he said, did you ever think in terms of Israel to pursue ping-pong diplomacy the way America did with China? We had such bad relations, so we sent ping-pong players back and forth to bring the two countries together. Turns out, not too long after that one question that Blitzer asked, that Anwar Sadat was the first Arab leader to go to Israel and to visit with the Knesset, and he attributed Blitzer's question to the reason why he did it. So it turns out that sometimes the questions that we ask can be more powerful than the answers. And that is a whole tribute also to Judaism because we have a whole, you know, people will say religion, oh, you're so blindsided, all you see is religion, religion, religion. Judaism, all we do the whole day is ask questions. As a journalist, I know when I interview a Jew, I don't even have to bring my own questions. They bring theirs. Jews are known for asking questions. and the Talmud and every rabbi, we're asking, we're taking God on, we're interrogating God 24 hours a day, and that's the way to find the truth. Not that other religions don't do it, I'm not excluding anybody from it, but I'm just saying that Jews tend to be very questioning. How much do I owe you?
Eric Cantor.
Eric Cantor, I was so impressed with this person. There's one traditional question I ask people when I interview them, and that is, if everything you own was on fire, because they tend to be billionaires, the whole gang of them, if everything you own was on fire, what's the one thing that you would save? So Larry King was going to save his awards, and this one was going to save his Louis Eichardt and his Picasso, whatever. I asked Eric Cantor, what would you save if your house was on fire? He said his tefillin, which is the phylacteries, the you know, the bands that Jews put on for their prayers every single morning. From everything he has and everything he's worth, he was ready to save that. And then I asked him, what would you save if America was on fire? And he said to me, the Constitution. And I am so glad now that Eric Cantor is the majority leader, because I think America is on fire. And I think that not rhetoric, but real hard substance and policy will put it out, and he's the man to do it.
I have a question for you, Elisa. I have found your commentary refreshing, and your assessments that you've made of the individuals that you've interviewed are just awesome. And it is true what you can see in the character and looking into the eyes of somebody or just looking at their body language. Who is someone who you have wanted to interview and have not yet been able to interview, and why? Who do you really want to interview at this time?
It's an interesting thing, because the people that I actually cared about most my whole life, I did meet them, and I did get to either interview them at length or in brief, but I met them all. And here's someone who would surprise you, seeing how right that I am, and it would be Oprah Winfrey. And it's for one reason only, and it actually ties in with my book. It's because Oprah Winfrey was put down her whole life. She was heavy. She was black, she was raped, she was this, she was that. She had every word, and my book is about the words that shaped me. She had every word against her. Everything was against her. But she did not let the words be her taskmasters, and she was not ready to be a descendant of slaves. She became the boss of the words. She obliterated every single word and every definition that should have put her down, and she rose above them. So, yes, I'd like to interview her, because as a person, I feel like an underdog my whole life, because I never fit into any group. I was religious, but I wasn't religious enough. I was smart, but I was blonde. I was this, but I was that. I had a foot in every world, so I never really fit into any of them. So I always appreciate the underdog who had everything against them, and they still triumphed. When I look at Oprah Winfrey, she is like the ugly duckling motif, you know? She turned into the swan in terms of, like, American success, and I would like to speak with her. I don't like her politics. I don't like who she sticks up for, but as a human being, and that's at the end of the day what we all are, that's on that level I would really like to appeal to her.
I think it would be fascinating to watch the interview. I'm from Chicago. I've met with Oprah, and if you were to be interviewed by her or you to interview her simultaneously on the course of a show, that would be a very, very fascinating program. I think we should make efforts to get you here to Chicago for such a show before she has her final weeks of the season, of this final season.
Eric, I'm liking you more than ever. I think it's a great
I mean,
idea.
If you go on Oprah, that's the ultimate stamp of approval. So we should really try to get you on there.
And, you know, I'm going to be a pessimist here. I've never sought the stamp of approval, because I always fought against the waves and the storm and everything. But if that would happen, I can't tell you. I wouldn't be overjoyed.
You would have the opportunity to just make a tremendous display as a Jewish woman, and to extend that genuine nature of who you are. And I think that that is something that Oprah would not be able to turn away. There's just a warmness as you speak.
Thank you for saying that. I really appreciate it.
I could get you Sarah Palin if you want.
Okay. I'm not complaining, but the last time I saw the Palin Book Review Club, I didn't. I'm not going to finish my joke, because I can't do it.
Okay.
You know, it reminds me of Jack. You know, if you like Jackie Mason, which I love him, and he's a good friend of mine, but when you see his show, he's on stage, and he starts laughing, and he goes, oh, sorry, I just told myself a better joke than I'm going to tell you. So that's what just happened right now.
Talking about all these individuals, you have also a paragraph called Role Model, and I find it very interesting. You write, did you know that today's youth spend approximately 6 hours a day in front of a screen, either the TV, the computer, video games, iPhones, etc.? So who is filling the moral gap for them? Tiger Woods, Rob Blagojevich, Michael Vick, Timothy Geithner, Britney Spears, Elliot Spitzer? Can you imagine taking the morality of all these individuals, putting them in a blender, and then pouring this slimy smoothie into an impressionable youth? What is the solution to this? How can we change it if we want to be on the right track?
Listen, I think I don't know if we have even a fight to win there. America, the liberal left of Hollywood has taken over, first of all, who the role models are. You have the slick shooters, you have the sexy, you have, I don't even know if I can look at anybody on TV and say, you know what, that's a role model. I mean, we had Tiger Woods, everybody thought a family man, this, that, an athlete. So I don't think that you could point to anybody. But if you will ask me who my role model will be, maybe this is the solution to the answer. No one should be your role model, because at the end of the day, every single one of us are just a human being, and we will fail and we will fall. So if you put all your eggs in that one basket, that he was everything I lived and died for, and then he messes up, you have nothing to look up to anymore. What my method of operandi was find the best in each person. If you can take a little bit here and a little bit there, and if you can put together at the end a little accumulation of the best of everybody and make it work for you, that's what you should go with. And even more so, I don't believe in life it's who you look up to, that's what should really drive you. I think it's who looks up to you. The Talmud tells you, if there's no man, then be the man. You have to be the presence in the room. I have little cousins, I have friends, I have family, I have a niece, I have a nephew. They look up to me. I'm a nothing, I'm a nobody, but I'm the one person they have to look up to. Let me be the role model. Let me do the right thing. When I tore my diploma, I don't know if your audience knows, I don't remember if you mentioned it or not. When Ahmadinejad was invited...
I'm going to mention it in the next...
You're going to mention it?
Yeah.
So then fine. So I'll just say here then that you be the role model. You be like, I think it was Gandhi who said, be the change you want to see. What are you looking at him to make the change? You're blaming the whole universe, the world is bad. Were you so good today? What did you do to make the world better?
Talking about bringing up this topic, I want to read an interesting part of your book. One morning back in 2007, I turned on the Fox News channel and heard that Columbia University, my alma mater, had invited Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to speak. I started to shake from the rage I was feeling, an emotion so rare to be placid, even-keeled person as myself. This queen of questions had to ask herself on that day, what are you going to do about it? On September 24 that same year, amidst thousands of protesters, I called an international press conference in front of Columbia University in Manhattan, New York. Microphones from France, Germany, America, and other foreign media outlets were being shoved in my face. Later that night, I was interviewed on Fox, Hannity and Combs. Why? I could not, in good conscience, keep my diploma hanging on the wall, and in a symbolic gesture, I tore it in half before the entire world. I would not go silent into that dark night. And you continue to write, of course, as a journalist, I'm a strong advocate of freedom of speech. But even that freedom has its limits. One cannot cry fire in a crowded theater. Basically, the freedom to swing
Your fist ends where my nose begins. Ahmadinejad was hitting everything I believed in right in the nose. The Iranian leader sponsors terrorism, is responsible for the death of our troops, is waging a proxy war against Israel through Hezbollah and Hamas, is a Holocaust denier, calls to wipe Israel off the map, and is engaged in a nuclear program that will not only be directed at Israel, but will be affect the entire Western world as he shares his lethal technologies with terrorists. People have asked me, what I gained by ripping up my diploma? Do I regret it? My answer is very simple. How can you ever regret standing up for what you believe in? It is in those moments that shape you and all those who look upon you to lead the way. Now I'm going to ask you this question. Are Jews in the United States standing up for what's right? And how do you address the campuses' attacks on Israel, the boycotts on Israeli products, the delegitimization of Israel, and so on?
Well, I think even your first question is such a huge question. If you ask me, okay, are the American Jews doing right? How do you define right? Do you define right that are they there for Israel? I will tell you no. I mean, these are the same Jews that brought Obama to be a president, and they didn't bring him there with a blank slate. They knew that the man sat in a church for 20 years, a church that hated America, that hated Zionists, that hated Jews, but that fact wasn't good enough. But then there was a time that he had a dinner with a Columbia University professor that was probably so inflammatory that the LA Times is still hiding the video from that. And he's made his statements and he had his feelings about the Jews for a long time. So when the Jews went to vote for President Obama in America, they had a history on the man and they still voted for him. You ask me now, do I feel that they did right? I will tell you no, that they did wrong. But why would somebody do wrong? Do they think they're doing wrong? I'm going out today to do wrong? No, obviously they think they did right. We think they did wrong because probably we know something that they didn't know, and that's called Jewish history. We know how Jews who had no place to live and had no Israel and had no one there for us and people who didn't love Jews, we know what the circumstances were. The circumstances were 6 million Jews were sent into a gas chamber. Not all 6 million of them, they all died there. Some went to the gas chamber, but at the end of the day, 6 million Jews died because we didn't have friends in the right places. To me, it's a big leap to say Obama and gas chambers, but what I'm trying to say is that these people are having, they have a vacuum in their history. They don't know why Jews died for Israel. They don't know why Jews are fighting for Israel. They don't know why blood is being shed for Israel. That's one part. Are Jews doing right? We have now a new generation of rich Jews who have a lot of philanthropic money to pass over to the next generation. The problem is Jews used to give that same very money to Israel. I know when I grew up, we had that blue and white box in my kitchen, you know, that little coin box where you put your charity in for Israel. The Jews are not giving their money to Israel anymore. They want to save the opera. They want to save the whales. They want to save everything, but they don't want to save the Jews. And then you have the kids.
Continue, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead, please.
I was going to say what pains me in the matter is this. Rashid Khalidi, and that's someone you are referencing who was at Columbia. Back in September 2009, there was a hate conference on Israel, a divestment conference, and I put together a peaceful rally protest on that weekend to take place on a Sunday afternoon. And what was so troublesome was when I went to the Jewish Federation to share with them that this was going on and that I wanted information to get out to the community at large so we could be there together to gather in force in peacefulness. The Federation said to me, we're not going to do it. But if I look at all the other things that they want to do and have done, they did so wholeheartedly. And I was told afterwards that this was something seen as too controversial. And I'm like, we have a duty and obligation to point out the truth on these matters, and that this is someone who is a friend and confidant of the current president. So I'm glad you make the point and the strong stand that you took, because I had a dear friend whose father is an Israeli diplomat, and she was at Columbia when you did that, and you made a very powerful statement. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the thank you. It was not the easiest thing ever done, but I did it from my heart, where all things emanate from me. But in terms of Jews and why they're not standing up for things, I mean, they've become very Americanized. They've become like every other immigrant or every other comfortable person in America. You have your Facebook, your Twitter, your BlackBerry. What do I care about a camel in the Middle East? But the one thing that they don't remember is that the Jews of post-Weimar Germany, they too felt more German than Jewish, and they were very comfortable. A Jew can never be too comfortable. The ground beneath their feet is never safe.
Correct.
Regardless of the well-intentioned people, and there are, I'm not telling you everybody hates us. Jews have a lot of friends, and I have a lot of evangelical Christian friends who are so supportive of Israel and Jews. But, you know, the gun prevails. These are the nicer people, so they do the right thing. But the people who want to do wrong, they take it to the extreme level. And those are the people we have to worry about. And I think that, you know, my own synagogue now in Montreal, where I grew up, where I was a bride, where I prayed when my father died and where I mourned for him, was just vandalized. I just got an email this morning, your synagogue was vandalized. So here I am, a journalist in New York, and I'm safe and I'm cool, and you know everybody knows my name in the small world that I have. At the end of the day, what I count and where I was born and who I am, a Jew, is being attacked at the end of the day, and no title will take that away. Next question, please.
Next question.
Oh, no, you can have the same question. I don't mind. I just, what I had to say was done.
Listen, when I let Eric talk, I just let him lead the question.
Yeah, I like Eric very much. I feel we're in sympatico here with a lot of things.
Eric, another guy you met in real life and you got to interview him was Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, before we go into part of that interview, here's what you write about him. I learned from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that our hopes, more than our hurts, must guide our future. First, how did you get that guidance from him? And do you think that as a acting Prime Minister of Israel, he's followed by that guidance?
I got that guidance from him because when I interviewed him, that's the exact sentence he told me, that our hopes, much more than our hurts, have to guide us. And yes, I do think that he's pursuing it to some measure, because if you think of Netanyahu, what he went through, his brother was the only military casual of the Entebbe raids. I mean, your audience, I'm sure, is familiar with that, Yoni Netanyahu. And he would have a lot to be angry about. He looked up to his brother. He loved his brother. He mourned over his brother. If you read articles about him, you'll hear that Netanyahu couldn't eat food for weeks. He couldn't even swallow because of the pain and the suffering of what he went through with his brother. When I asked him, why didn't you name your two sons? As you know, Jews, when somebody dies in our family, the first thing we do is we name a child after them. He couldn't name his children after his brother because he felt that the burden was too high. It was too high. He didn't want to pain them, and that they should have to carry that, you know, they shouldn't have to carry the cross or bear the burden of it. And he even said to me that when he met Winston Churchill's grandson, and the grandson is named William, you know, Spencer, what's his name? Winston Spencer Churchill, yes. He felt bad for him because it's such a big burden. And it's such big shoes to fill. He couldn't do that to his kids. So you would think Netanyahu is guided by all those emotional feelings. But at the end of the day, and he made it very clear to me, he said, despite everything that I went through and the hurts and the pains that I felt, is that none of my ideologies were guided by my brother's death, nor by his father's Jabotinsky-like views. He has only one thing that guided him. And you want to know what that thing is? The survival of the Jewish people. And the survival of the Jewish people is dependent on the strength of Israel. We cannot rely on the good graces of our hosts in any country. We have to be backed by arms. I'm sorry to say it, because if you read my blog this week, you don't know I don't like gun analogies. But Israel has to live and die by the gun. Like Netanyahu himself said, if the Arabs will put down their guns, there'll be peace. If Israel puts down their guns, there'll be no more Israel. So, you know, there's nothing more to say after that, because obviously so many years of bloodshed has proven that to be true.
Would you, I read it in the book and I found it very, very, very interesting. But I'll give you the time to share with the audience the very interesting story, how you met Prime Minister Netanyahu, your dream about him. It's in the book on page 107. I would say it's very dramatic. So before we go into questions, you asked him, what's the story with that dream?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you had to say.
I say you write about the dream you dreamt of Prime Minister Netanyahu before you met him. Would you share with the audience that story?
Ugh, really? I thought you were going to read it. All right, so here's the story. Everybody who knows me knows I don't sleep at night. My Facebook friends will text me or email me at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'll answer them. And they're like, why are you answering me at 4 o'clock in the morning? Because at the end of the day, I don't sleep at night. Why don't I sleep? It's because I've been burdened by many years now, by very bad dreams. What's that dream? I don't even know if I should read it. I don't know if it'll be more dramatic or not. Anyway, the bad dream is, for many years, I am in a situation where Jews are being killed, and killed mercilessly. Throats are being slashed, and children are being murdered. And it's endless blood and violence, and there's just no one to appeal to. There's no part of humanity that's available. And in the same dream, I'm always saving a child, and just as about I'm to be killed and, you know, join the masses in this big execution, there's somebody who comes to me and says, Aliza, follow me, follow me. And they take me away from the violence, and they say, don't go too far away, stay here, stay here. And there's I don't know if it's a rabbi, somebody with a beard, and they come to me, and they call me by the name of Eden. And they say, Eden, your destiny is tied in the future with this person you just met. But the dreams are so real, and there's so much bloodshed, and there's so much agony and pain and suffering that really, I haven't slept half a lifetime. I've had this dream since I was a child. And it's funny, I mean, there's some things that are not in the book, but almost till the day I got married, I was in my parents' room. I had a bad dream, wake up, wake up. And I was ready, a big girl. But one morning, I'm dashing out of my parents' house, and there's a newscast on TV. And somebody's talking, there's this Scud war going on. And I hear a voice, and I look at the TV, say, who's this person? My father says, oh, it's so-and-so, whatever, Netanyahu, his brother. I don't even remember that part of it so much. I said, that's the person I saw in my dream. That's the person I saw in my dream. I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional now, even as I talk about it so many years, but it's just painful. And it was Benjamin Netanyahu on the TV, and that's the face that I saw in my dreams all those years, that person who saved me in that dream. And my parents, you know, they're traditional Jewish people. They always say, well, you should go maybe see a Kabbalistic rabbi. Why did you have a dream? And, you know, they didn't see me as crazy, you know, because you're always afraid to say I had a dream because dreams are like nuts and you don't even want to talk that way. I even debated putting this in the book. And they said, go see a Kabbalistic rabbi. But by then I had become a little bit religious, and I knew that whoever interprets a dream actually gives it some credence in the real world. So you always, even whatever dream you have to be careful who you give it to, because their interpretation might bring it to somehow reality. And I was afraid another rabbi would tell me I have to wear a more sneeze conservative outfit, and I didn't want to bring the story to anybody. In any case, obviously, after that day, actually, I never dreamt that same dream again about him. I only dreamt after the Jews were being slaughtered and killed and murdered and there was blood. But I never saw that face, which was Netanyahu's again. And I don't know, maybe I was 20 at the time. I don't even know. And the Scud War broke out. It was 91, I think. But I pursued the knowledge of Netanyahu after that, and I investigated who he was, what he was, and then I found out about Yoni, his brother, who was the sole military casualty, as I said earlier, in the Entebbe operation. And it just dawned on me how life is so empty when you have nothing to fight for. Because I was thinking to myself, really, if you have nothing that you're ready to die for, as Yoni did or as the Israelis are doing every day, if you have nothing that you're ready to die for, then you have nothing that you're ready to live for. So I just started, I mean, that's what really sparked my whole, my father gave me the beautiful stories about Ariel Sharon, but they didn't spark my Zionism in any way that made me active. But Yoni's story did. And I studied Netanyahu, this and that, not with like a fascination or any crazy type of degree, but I monitored him and I was very interested, obviously. And I think it's 7 or 8 years after that that I had the opportunity to interview him. And people would think I'd be freaked out, but I actually wasn't, because I felt like I knew him my whole life, and I actually did, because he was the one who rescued me in that dream where everyone was killing the Jews on a nightly basis. I'm sorry I'm choked up here. You guys are going to make me cry.
Listen, this is going to be...
Someone rescue me now.
Netanyahu.
What?
This is going to be sent to Prime Minister Netanyahu.
What, this?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think better not. And you know, it's interesting because when I think of Netanyahu, forget about me, but the word Netanyahu means a gift from God in Hebrew. And I think...
You read my mind, Eliza.
Yeah, okay, so I don't want to steal a question. If you have something to ask, or I can just continue.
Continue.
I was going to make a brief point, and I'm going to let you continue regarding that dream. And I wanted to mention the point of Netanyahu, meaning the Hebrew to God's gift, because I've been studying Hebrew for several years now. I've got dear Orthodox friends, and they're a little bit older than my mom and dad, and they've got members of their family that were on Schindler's List. In the last 5 to 8 years, Sandy has been having a recurring dream, very similar to what you've had in terms of the slaughter. And she sleeps very little now. And she said, things are so urgent. We have to act. We have to act. And as you spoke about that dream, it's riveting because Sandy and her husband, Fred, often will tell me about what they dream. And it's recurring over and over. And they're like, we cannot act fast enough. We simply can't do enough. What are we supposed to do? And doesn't anybody else around us see it, see what's coming? And it's just your thoughts. I want to read more from your book regarding what you're talking about right now. So thank you for sharing what you're discussing. I know it's deep. It goes to the core of you as a person. And it's a reality that people have to understand about what you're discussing right now.
So what you're saying, there is, time is of the essence now. And if you read Winston Churchill's, well, I think it was 7 books, The Gathering Storm, everybody looked at him like he was a fool, the same way they looked at Netanyahu many years ago like he was a fool. But they look at anybody who has a little bit of hyperbole in their conversation. But at the end of the day, there is a gathering storm. And the night is growing dark. And I think it's probably darker than ever because we have the means of global destruction today. Before we had the rhetoric, today we have the means. And Israel is a tiny sea. I mean, I don't know if you were addressing specifically Israel or America or the world, but I'm looking at Israel now in terms of our conversation tonight, and there is a gathering storm. You have a very small country surrounded by a sea of Arabs. Israel makes up 0.5% of the land of the Middle East. And yet that 0.5%, everybody's lusting upon it like a pack of wolves. Like that's what they were missing for world happiness. And I'm thinking now, the one thing when I left that interview with Netanyahu, Bobsy, there's two things he really wanted me to know, or to make sure that it was told. And one was how small Israel is. We're so small. The state of California alone, and here we are 50 states, but the state of California alone is 16 times bigger than the state of Israel. And Iran is 75 times bigger than the state of Israel. Pre-67, Israel at its narrowest point was 9 miles long. I have to tell you guys, I do that on the treadmill some ambitious mornings. It's such a small country, and they're asking so much more. They're extracting and trying to extract from us so much more than they would ask of anybody else in the whole world. Ask me why. There's no oil there. There's nothing there but a few Jews and a good laboratory and a few good scientists. What do they want from us?
We are running out of time, but I was reading the interview with Premis and Netanyahu, and I found this important part, as it means a lot to the situation right now. And you write there, you quote Premis and Netanyahu, there are some leaders who do everything right because they hold their finger to the wind to test the polls. Someone like that may win 100 elections, but me, Netanyahu, being in a position of leadership is not the same thing as leading. A leader is someone who is guided by his own values and does what he thinks is right and is ready to take flake for it, to take hits for it, and to lose for it. The situation right now, with the peace process and the Palestinians, the Obama administration, has Netanyahu led Israel in the past 2 years, as he says, not by polls, but only by his own values and the best interests for Israel?
Listen. How you live up to your own values doesn't only have one recipe. It doesn't have to be, this is what I believe, and it's my way or the highway. You could do that maybe with a husband or this or that, but when you're dealing with international affairs, just let's say we all believe in this conversation that Obama's a big hypocrite and he doesn't wish Israel well. Why does Netanyahu have to go there and say, you know what, you're a big hypocrite and you don't wish Israel well? Why can't he play the same game as him? Politics in Israel is in dog years. For every 1 year in America, it's 7 years in Israel. You think Netanyahu doesn't know Obama? He was Obama. He was Obama 20 years ago. He knows what he forgot Obama has yet to know. Netanyahu, listen, in Israel you can't please anybody. I remember the joke when they said that when Golda met Nixon, she said, you think you have a hard job? You're the president of 200 million people, but me, I'm the president of 3 million prime ministers. In Israel, everybody's a prime minister, and everybody knows better, and everybody knows the right thing to do, and if they would be Netanyahu, blah, blah, blah. At the end of the day, he's the one who's, his back is against the wall. Let him tell Obama what he wants to hear. Let him tell him. You have to survive politically, too. Listen, all of us have a friend who has a big mouth, and we always advise the friend, why do you have to have such a big mouth? Keep it to yourself. So that's the way you feel. Don't you have a friend like that? I have friends like that. They have a big mouth, and I always think they should have kept their mouth shut. Why does it apply differently to the prime minister of a very important country? Let him keep his mouth shut. So he'll make a few Israelis mad. He'll make Obama a little bit happy. At the end of the day, the peace process is going nowhere, and I would be very upset about that if it really was a peace process, but this is not a peace process. This is how we can kill more Jews, how we can evacuate Jews from Israel. This is not a peace process. So let him entertain everybody until he has to entertain everybody. Yes, so back to your ultimate question, do I agree with Netanyahu? Yes, he's a very good politician and a wise leader. He messed up the first time. Netanyahu doesn't want to mess up this round. He's a student of Churchill. His father's a Jabotinsky historian. His brother died because of Arabs. His kids are in the army. You think you think that Netanyahu is going to sacrifice Israel? He spent a lifetime protecting it. Believe me, with his brains, he could have got a job in America for $1 million a year. He didn't need Israel and all the problems. He has enough pictures with Clinton. He could have moved on in life.
Definitely very right. Okay. One of the main lies exposed in your book, and I come to it as we...
But wait. We have to say the name of my book, because maybe after this interview, one person will buy it. So the name of my book is The Words That Shaped Me, and please continue.
You write that one of the main lies is that stick and stones can break your bones, but words can never harm you. Following the tragic Arizona shooting, you wrote in your blog post that davidovit.blogspot.com, I think, on Sunday, and I quote, "Although it has been proven in this tragic case that the rhetoric of the right did not pull the trigger, and they were indeed blood libeled by the left, let's not pretend that words don't matter. Was it not we Republicans and conservatives who went down in a shameful defeat in 2008, recognizing that a senator with a short resume assumed the most powerful job in the world, not by experience, but by offering sweet-sounding words such as hope and change? Those winning words may have very well fundamentally changed the course of America and world affairs. Therefore, with all due respect to my favorite conservative talk show host, if words don't matter, then why are they talking for a living? They can't have it both ways. If they feel their words and arguments can foment people to vote and reignite lagging patriotism, they have to also recognize that their words can lead people down many paths, even dangerous ones." And you conclude the article by saying, yes, the right are wrong, but the left are to blame. Now, first of all, a new USA Today Gallup poll finds only 20% say the heated rhetoric was a major factor in the shooting, while 22% cite it's a minor factor, and 42% say it was not a factor at all. So what makes you confident of your view that the words by the political conservative talk show host may have had something to do with this incident?
Okay, so there I was deficient as a writer to say that I was not referring to the case above. I wasn't referring to the Arizona case. I was referring to the case, and there's quite a few paragraphs in between where you started and where you ended, where I spoke about how the liberal Hollywood is glamorizing guns. They are the same people who are accusing Sarah Palin of saying, oh, you're in the crosshairs and we have to reload. But this is the same liberal Hollywood who calls the Tea Partiers loons with guns, you know, gun-toting conservatives. But these are the ones who are glamorizing guns in movies like The Godfather and Bugsy and Scarface and The Goodfellas and so on and so forth. So what I was trying to say was the glamorization of guns in America is actually not the fault of the Republicans or the conservatives. It's actually these liberals who speak about it against one side of their mouth, you know, politically that it's wrong, but they glamorize it in every movie that it's really cool to pack a gun. I mean, hey, I almost want one after I saw that Clint Eastwood movie, like, Make My Day. You know, so I probably missed a sentence there to really confirm what I was saying, if that's how you understood it. I'm not going against the polls. I do not think that the Republicans at all in any way were connected with this. I didn't think it even before. However, everybody who has a guilty conscience, there's an expression in Judaism that often gone friend to hitl. If you're guilty right away, and it means in English that on the head of the thief, the hat is burning. So you'd say, oh, the hat is burning, and every guilty conscience will grab for his head to see if his own hat is burning. So when something goes wrong and you think it might be you, like if a Jew messed up, oh, I hope he's not Jewish. If it's a liberal, I hope he's not liberal. If conservative, I hope he's not conservative. So everybody with an almost guilty conscience showed up that day. I didn't think it was them. I'm not blaming them. All I was trying to say in that article, as I do say in my book, is that words do matter. They don't. Words are very soft. You think they evaporate into thin air because they came from your mouth. There's no substance. You can't touch them. But I can promise you, I don't remember how many times I bruised my knee as a kid in terms of sticks and stones can break your bones or who punched me or whatever. But I do remember the words that they called me. And it's the same thing in the rhetoric and in the way we address each other in politics today. The words do matter. They matter. Let's not pretend they don't. Otherwise, Glenn Beck wouldn't have a job and Rush Limbaugh wouldn't have a job. The words matter. And we just have to be a little careful. That's all. I'm not blaming anybody. They're not guilty in this case. But I don't want anybody to be running for the hat in the next case and say, oh, my God, was it me this time? If your argument is so right, if you are so right and you have all the facts to prove it, what do you have to use that type of dialogue for? You don't have to use it. If your facts are overwhelming, you can have a different discussion. That's not really what I meant about it. And also, you know, we don't need to talk that way to each other. We don't need to talk about guns. Talk about policy, get to the facts, and leave the guns to the shooting range.
To Dick Cheney.
No, don't leave him to Dick Cheney.
No,
that's the best
I don't
example.
Want to be shot when in the field.
You're better off leaving him to me.
What conclusion, therefore, have you drawn out of this debate? And how do we draw the lines, especially when we're entering now a year of a political divided legislature in Washington and we are drawing closer to the 2012 presidential elections?
Listen, everything we everything we believe in is on the line right now. So get as mean as you could be. If you find out the guy cheated on his wife or he robbed a bank or has ever low and slimy politics, you can go for it. If it's true, bring it out to the surface. But don't say put them in the crosshairs because, you know, we're living a little bit crazy times where morality is not a strong point today. So try and find different words to go with right now, like go to the voting booth, cast your ballot. You know, push those words instead of the crosshairs. Unless you have an alternate agenda, then I have nothing to say to you.
You know, it's interesting. You're bringing up the notion of voting. And to just conclude, one of the final questions about what you write in your book. Here's the word sometimes. Sometimes is such a weak word that it deserves no definition or etymological tracing of its roots. Dictionary.com must agree with me because it provides no history of usage either. But I go even further to say that this lame word also has no future. Sometimes bothers me so much in the same way that prefix half does, half ready, half done. If you ask a question, somebody, did you ever smoke? He says, sometimes. Did you ever cheat on your mate? Sometimes. Did you ever vote? Sometimes. You can ask any person 1,000 questions, and if they answer every single one with that same reply, you'll never know a single thing about them. Does voting sometimes make you patriotic? Does cheating sometimes make you a family man? Does praying sometimes make you religious? The word does not allow you to be defined as one thing or another, and that is why I offered it no definition, as I did with all the other words. I find the world of sometimes a world without courage and consistency, a place where people don't have to characterize themselves but get away with a lot. I go to the gym sometimes. I go to church sometimes. I text and drive sometimes. I vote liberal sometimes. I visit my grandmother sometimes. Sometimes makes us feel not guilty and gives us cover from criticism. This is very powerful.
And the question is?
No question. I'm just quoting your book.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad you're quoting it today and not just sometimes.
That's very generally thought.
I'm never going to answer if I'm hungry sometimes.
I'm hungry for chocolate right now, Jacob.
Well, I'm glad you're just hungry because I drive most people to drink, so we're off to a good start.
Yeah, and I drink sometimes. Go ahead, Eric. You wanted to ask a very personal but important question.
Aliza, I know that you are a classical pianist, and I was just excited about that. And I'm so used to doing interviews and asking very serious questions on counterterrorism and everything within that realm. I have several goals in my life, and one of them is the completion of a private pilot license, and the other one is learning to master the piano. As a boy, when I grew up, my mom played the piano all the time, and we had this beautiful baby half-grand Steinway down in the living room area, and it was common that I would wake up in the morning time to her softly playing. It was just wonderful. What are sources of influence in your life for taking up the piano?
Well, before we get to the piano, I need to know that private pilot license of yours, do you only plan on one-way flights or no? We just need to check in.
No, I've actually been up in the air. I just love flying. Engineering's in my background academically, so
I have to admire you for that one, because if you would see the sight of me getting on an airplane, you would surely have a comic routine for a long time to come. Good for you on that. With piano, it started as all little kids are started on piano, is my mother forced me. She said, ballet or piano? And since I gave up on ballet after two lessons, it was piano. Yes, I'm a classical pianist by training, but I can't tell you that I loved classical piano, which means Mozart and his whole oeuvre there, all his friends. Although I'm glad that I was trained that way, because you're trained really structured and by format. That's what classical piano is. But at the end of the day, I was just in love with impressionistic music, which was like Ravel and Debussy, which that's what I loved to play, because and it suits my personality, is they broke all the forms and they broke all the molds. And if you listen to that music, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Ravel and Debussy, but it literally sounds like, water streaming from a waterfall. It's just so beautiful. And I am structured by character. I'm an A-type personality. So Mozart on top of me is you have a Nazi here. So I fell into the impressionistic type of music because it just broke all the rules in so many ways.
Right. It's awesome to hear you talk about that. And I have had for a period of time season tickets for the Chicago Symphony, and I can still remember it was 1994 when I watched Baron Boehm on the piano and Itzhak Perlman perform together, and it was just incredible. Who are some of your musical inspirations today? Who are some of those virtuosos that you follow?
A virtuoso of today? I can't tell you. Listen, today I'm still a cool chick at the end of the day, so if I'm following today, it's not virtuosos of today. You know, I'm looking for the virtuosos of the past.
Today, like a rock
today, I don't know if you guys are, I think you're familiar with Matisse Yahu, you guys, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Right.
Favorite.
I wouldn't call him a virtuoso, but I bring him up because he's in the musical field, and I know that you guys are familiar with him. And I like about him because everybody will look at him and say, oh, my God, this guy should be like a rabbi and, you know, singing like klezmer music. And this guy's like a reggae star of the universe. So I like when people break molds and they break traditions. So I know I pulled you very far away from classical piano. So today's virtuosos, I'm not looking at them that way. I studied by the classics. I can only look up to them as my virtuosos. And like I said, I landed in the impressionistic world because it gave me liberty.
Right.
But I think that you should pursue your piano dreams. I really think you should go for it.
There's just a great, awesome power when you sit at the piano and you just become a part of the piano, and what comes from you flows through the piano, and you sit on that stage. I had the opportunity to sit in an auditorium several years ago with at the piano all alone with nobody around, and I just played to my heart's content. So it was an awesome experience. I smiled greatly then and still now.
So who, can I ask you a question? Is the journalist allowed to ask a question at the end of the story?
Yes, I have to answer. The answer has to be me.
What?
His answer has to be me.
I have
to take
Jacob.
Okay, we'll go with that one for the record.